I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that anger and hate is playing a bigger role in this federal election than in any in recent memory. First, there are the mobs that have been following the liberal leader on the campaign trail. They started with words and noise, but a little while ago they turned physical.
At least one protester threw what appeared to be gravel or small stones at Trudeau while he was boarding his bus. The Liberal leader told reporters afterwards he was, in fact, hit, but was okay.
If that evidence wasn't enough, there are also protesters screaming outside of hospitals, yelling anti-vaccine and anti-mask rhetoric at healthcare workers and cancer patients. And if you were looking for a way to quantify this kind of anecdotal evidence, I could point you to some recent polls, which show that Maxime Bernier's People's Party, overwhelmingly the preferred party of the people leading these protests, is quickly climbing the charts. According to one recent survey, they are on target to receive as much as 9% of the vote. We are still a ways from Election Day, but for context, that 9% would be far more than the Green Party has ever received, and almost half of what the New Democratic Party is currently polling at. That is a significant number of Canadians. So where did this hate come from? How did it get this far? And most importantly, at least where your vote is concerned, what are the major parties planning to do about it? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Evan Balgord is the executive director of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. Also, he's an investigative journalist that's been covering the rise of the far right and hate groups in Canada. Hey, Evan.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. I'm glad that we had you today because I took a look at some polls this morning, and over the last few days, Maxime Bernier and the People's Party, I think it's fair to say, at least by a couple of pollsters, have been polling much higher than I think anybody expected. The highest I think we've seen now is 9% nationally. And when you see numbers like that, what's your reaction?
It still remains to be seen whether they're going to win any seats. Probably the most likely seat for them to win would be Bernier's himself. Still, kind of the rise in their popularity is concerning, right? And it can be largely attributed to the fact that they are the most mainstream party that is really against a variety of public health measures under the COVID crisis, right? But their party is more than just the COVID conspiracy party. Their party is the xenophobia party, right? I've lost count of how many executives from that party or candidates themselves were caught making just explicitly racist statements. And, you know, some of those candidates were removed, but a lot of them weren't. And it really has just come to be the party that is most favored by the far right in Canada, which is like largely jaded on regular electoral politics. Like sometimes they might strategically vote conservative, but a lot of them don't vote because they have kind of no faith in the system. They're very anti-government generally. But Bernier is kind of hoovering up that segment of the population.
Is it better that these people identify themselves publicly as being affiliated with this kind of ideology versus practicing it in the shadows? I mean, this is kind of an unabashed declaration that if you're for the People's Party, you support some of this stuff.
Yeah, no, it's much better that they're back under their rocks. It's kind of how this thing goes, right? Deplatforming the far right and the racist right is so important because when they're deplatformed and they don't connect with each other so much, they're not so organized, that stops things from spiraling out of control, right? Because when a bunch of them get together, it sends a message and kind of reinforces what their social norms and social values are. It reinforces the fact that they can find other people who will cheer and laugh along with them when they make, you know, racist comments or racist jokes. So it's actually much better when the far right is not connecting to each other because they feel the social stigma of saying, you know, overtly hateful things. So they kind of self-censor. And that's the best case scenario. So no, it's actually quite a negative thing that, you know, the far right in Canada has been growing and networking. And now it has a preferred kind of political party, right? And they're trying to enter their xenophobia into Canadian politics, we were much safer and much better off when the PPC was not a thing.
Given that rise in terms of political affiliation, how has that correlated, if at all, with what we've seen in terms of the actual number of reported hate crimes or hate incidents in Canada? I'm just going to ask, since the last election, since we're going to talk about the party platforms here.
So we don't really have good numbers tracking hate crimes in Canada.
I just want to stop you right there and ask that question.
It really comes down to the fact that we're not looking for them. We're not looking to get an accurate answer to that question. Your listeners may or may not know, every year Canada does surveys. Statistics Canada does surveys and asks people all sorts of things, like, do you own a car? What's your education level? All sorts of things. And every 5 years, they repeat a portion on victimization, where Statistics Canada just calls, and I believe the last time they did this, they called like 22,000 people and just asked them, hey, have you been the victim of a crime? And one of the questions they asked was, have you been the victim of a hate crime? The only two times that they've kind of asked that question in recent history were in 2014 and were in 2019. And the result was that Statistics Canada estimates that there are 223,000 cases of self-reported hate crimes in 2019. And that's before COVID, right? We know from the police reported data, which is really bad for a variety of reasons, but it can kind of point to trends. The police reported data says, you know, in 2019, I think it was something like a 37% increase over 2019. So 2019, 2020, it got worse, right? And I would say it's only probably gotten worse in 2021. So almost a quarter of a million hate crimes in 2019, and all indications are it's only gotten worse.
Where is this increase coming from? I know this is probably asking you to diagnose a huge problem, but in your work, have you seen where it starts to bubble to eventually reach the surface?
Very much so. I mean, you can track this, and it's perhaps an oversimplification, but I think it's a useful in just having a general conversation about this. And the answer is the internet, right? The answer is social media platforms. Because people don't learn to hate out of nowhere. And when we look at, like, especially youth getting radicalized into, you know, neo-Nazi terrorist movements and things like that, it's almost entirely happening online. And when it's, you know, older persons who might be part of, you know, an anti-Muslim group or, you know, COVID conspiracy stuff, again, it's most of them find it at first on traditional social media platforms. Mm-hmm. From there, sometimes they get, you know, quite into it, and then they may connect with other people on more obscure platforms that have essentially no rules. So we've seen a rise in online hate, and that's kind of tracked and documented by a number of studies. And at the same time, all indications show that hate crimes have been on the rise as well, right? That's what communities have been telling us for a while now, and their experiences are borne out by the data that Statistics Canada collected. So it really is coming online. And it's, you know, we're 6 years or so at this point into the rise of the new far right, the rise of a new kind of fascist and insurrectionary movement in Canada, the far right and the racist right. But the way that they have grown and continue to grow is entirely internet driven.
Have you seen any party, and we'll get into the platforms in a moment, but I just want to talk about the general conversation around the campaign, and are the parties themselves, the party leaders, are they talking about this? Are they addressing the rise in hate in Canada?
You know, I'll say that they have done like one or two little things, like, you know, condemning the racist slogans or swastikas, you know, that have been spray painted or drawn on lawn signs, right? Like there's a few little bits and pieces they've done that may kind of touch on racism. And of course, they have been talking more about reconciliation for Canada's genocide of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples. So they've kind of touched on things that touch on racism, but have they talked about kind of overt hate and hate crime? No, they haven't talked about that at all on the campaign trail. And it's disappointing to us because, you know, that data came out during the election. Hmm. And that says that you're more likely to be the victim of a hate crime in Canada than you are to be hurt in a car crash. And I make that comparison because we go to a lot of effort to make sure that there are less car crashes and people get less hurt in car crashes, right?
Right.
We have a bigger problem with hate crime, but we've done nothing to address it, right? And it hasn't even been a subject. It's not a subject during the debates. It hasn't been discussed on the campaign trail. And if that's just so shocking, especially given that there's a violent insurrectionary movement that is literally stalking the prime minister. So it does seem to be like a glaring thing that is being missed.
It may please you to know that we're talking today because a number of our listeners, when we asked for issues that we need to discuss that they may be voting on, selected racism and hate in Canada, which is why we wanted to talk to you. And so let's start with the Liberals since 2019. What can Trudeau reasonably claim to have done to combat this?
What have they done that have made kind of a noticeable big difference in our work? Nothing. What have they done that may kind of yield good future results? There's a couple things. First, I'd say that, you know, while this government has been in power, the Canadian Armed Forces, partly and actually largely as a result of a lot of our investigative work exposing, you know, neo-Nazis and the terrorist type of neo-Nazis active within the armed forces. The armed forces has responded by, you know, initiating a process, and it's a large bureaucracy. I do think that they are trying, but a process by which, you know, to more quickly and tend to choose release more as a default when they find that a member is, you know, a member of a hate group or a member of a neo-Nazi or a would-be terrorist group. They have a bit of an uphill battle there because people try to hide their views from their employer, right?
Right.
That happened under the Liberal government. I think that maybe they can take some credit through that. We did have meetings with the defense minister kind of on the subject, and we have made progress there. Right before the election, they proposed two pieces of legislation. The first would bring back something called Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act. And this would be very, very impactful and important. We used to have this law. And basically what it does is that any member of the public can make a complaint to the Canadian Human Rights Commission, and provided that it's a serious and a legitimate complaint, their complaint can be heard by a tribunal. And their complaint would be, you know, that so-and-so person is spreading a lot of hatred in a dangerous way towards a group. And the tribunal could order that person to cease and desist, right? And it worked. It worked for several years. It was challenged by neo-Nazis, and it was upheld by the courts as constitutional. Despite that, it was repealed by the Harper Conservatives. And since then, we haven't had any tool to hold hate mongers accountable. Back then, they said, you know, we already have criminal law against hate propaganda, the willful promotion of hatred. Why do we need this civil law, let's call it, or this other tool? Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is because the police aren't helpful. The law might be on the books, but it's like pulling teeth to get them to use it. And just they just don't is the short version of it. They don't at any kind of scope or scale. So the civilian law, what I'll call it, or that tool that gave communities access to justice was so impactful. So the Liberals proposed to bring back Section 13, which would be good. So they kind of proposed that. They proposed two pieces of legislation, and I can only give limited credit here because then they immediately called a snap election, right? So yeah. They immediately derailed kind of what they were talking about. The second thing they proposed was regulating social media companies, saying that they have to proactively remove hate. And that would be very impactful, and it's absolutely necessary right now. The time to do it was 5 years ago. The next best time to do it is as soon as possible.
Are those the major tenets of the Liberals' platform on hate and racism? And, you know, if not, give us a quick overview of what else is in there before we move on to the Conservatives.
Sure. So the Liberals have proposed those two pieces of legislation. And in additional to that, they're committing to a national anti-hate action plan by 2022. The deadline of that is good. You know, it speaks to some urgency, but there's not a lot of details there yet, right? It's kind of a promise to have a plan, which, you know, having a plan is better, but it's the next best thing. They had previously closed the door on looking at criminal code changes, and they've kind of reopened the door there. They're saying, okay, now we'll consider it. And the reason is that, let's say a woman is walking down the street, a woman wearing hijab is walking down the street and somebody is shouting like racist abuse at her. Right now, if a police officer is standing nearby, you know, they could charge that person with, you know, some kind of a misdemeanor, or they could choose just to shrug and say free speech, right? I mean, there's so much discretion on the officer level for these kind of things. Unfortunately, right now, there's only kind of like three things that are hate crimes, like quote unquote hate crimes in the criminal code. And they all deal with the willful promotion of genocide, vandalism targeting like a religious or a place of worship or a community center that belongs to a particular community, and the willful promotion of hate propaganda. So there, it's like a one, vandalism, and two, speech crimes, essentially. What a lot of people think are hate crimes, like let's say somebody is assaulted while somebody shouts slurs at them. That's what we'd call a hate crime. I still think that's the most useful language for it, but the criminal code doesn't consider that a hate crime. The criminal code considers that assault. And during sentencing, the individual may face a harsher sentence laid by the judge because there was a hate motivated factor to it. We're seeing, though, that's just not happening in so many cases, though. So police detect about like 1% of hate crime in Canada. They solve a small fraction of that 1%. So it's just not working, is the short version. Police are never going to be the whole answer, but it's not even working in kind of obvious cases. What changes the criminal code would do would just make it clear that the situation I gave in the beginning here, you know, a woman's going down the street being chased by somebody yelling racial slurs at her, would make it clear that that in and of itself is a crime, as it already could be considered a crime, but there's too much discretion on like an officer level. Changing the criminal code to say very clearly that that is a crime signals to law enforcement that they should be laying charges for it, and makes things a bit easier for the courts. And, you know, we're not the only ones saying that they should do that. There's former police officials saying that it just makes sense to do it. There's other advocacy organizations. And the other thing that they've promised is a national fund for the survivors of hate attacks, which is also a great idea. You know, we see communities come together in the wake of hate attacks and, you know, fundraise to take care of, for example, that poor boy that was orphaned by that terrorist attack on that London family. You know, the community rallies around and kind of fundraises and supports, but, you know, not in every situation is that possible or feasible or reasonable to expect of a community. So, you know, it's a great idea that, you know, while Canada is perpetuating so many hate crimes and isn't doing much to stop it, you know, it's a good idea to also have this fund to take care of the people who are being hurt.
That's a really good summary. And now I want to ask you about the conservative platform. And this is going to sound like I'm being sarcastic when I say that I was surprised to learn they had one. But that's only because there had been a lot of reporting about how the words racism or Islamophobia are not in their platform. So can you have a proactive platform against hate without those words? And what does their platform look like?
I think the absence of the word speaks to how much they kind of prioritize those issues in the scope of other things. So there's a number of things they've put forward, most of them bad, a couple of them terrible, one of them pretty good. So maybe we should start with the good one. Let's give a little credit where credit's due.
Yes.
You know, there's this thing called the Security Infrastructure Program. And basically how it works is, you know, let's say you have a synagogue or a mosque or some place of worship or some community center. And, you know, you're getting threats or repeatedly being graffitied, which can sometimes, you know, lead to worse vandalization or worse things happening. You can apply under this fund and it'll pay for security upgrades, you know, door locks, security cameras, things of that nature. It's a little hard to access right now. I'd also say in one case, it's been grossly abused. There is a Ukrainian facility in, I believe, Edmonton that actually applied for funds under the program because they had a statue of a Nazi. And somebody had gone and spray painted the words Nazi scum on their Nazi statue. And they applied for funds under this program to protect the Nazi statue, and they got those funds.
Huh.
So that's pretty gross.
Yeah.
In most cases, you know, this fund should be easier to access. That places of worship don't necessarily need to demonstrate like an imminent threat or anything because, you know, it's protection. It should be proactive. And it should go, like the conservatives mentioned, also be able to go towards things like security guards, right, at the front door. So doubling that fund and improving access to it is a good idea. So the other thing that they're offering up is, you know, $25 million to law enforcement to go after like online threats, hate speech, disinformation, things of that nature. That's like not terrible, but really the police don't need more money, period. I'll just make that as a blanket statement. They're just not interested in this stuff and they aren't very effective on it. And I'm speaking very generally here because there are some wonderful officers that I know in various hate crimes units that do care a lot. But when I'm talking about police, the institution, there's not a lot of interest on this stuff. There's lip service, but not a lot of interest. And we know that because Dr. Barbara Perry, you know, has done studies and asked officers and done surveys of police departments and just found that a lot of officers just don't see it as a priority. Or, you know, even more disturbingly, a lot of them voluntarily answered the survey to say it wasn't important. Like, they actually went out there to say, like, it's not important. We shouldn't be treating hate crimes any more seriously than regular crimes. And other officers report, like, I do care about it, but I feel that my fellow officers don't, or I feel that we go to all this effort and the Crowns aren't using what we're doing anyway. So, but the point being that there can be improvements made to the police, but there's a big culture issue here. They're not the silver bullet solution to this stuff.
Okay.
So the conservative platform also promises to criminalize online statements that incite violence. That's already criminal. That's already incitement. It's not being used for hate motivated stuff. So that's kind of a policy that doesn't mean anything. They also suggest imposing a stronger legal duty for social media platforms to remove illegal content. And here they define illegal content as content that incites violence, that is already illegal, but they would only have social media companies remove that content. So content that's just overtly hateful, they wouldn't require it to be removed. And that's bad because online hate leads to violence, right? I mean, there's a process. And if you don't go after online hate, if you only go after when it's explicitly violent, you're kind of missing the point.
So we're talking about the difference here between I hate slur X versus let's kill slur X. I just want to make sure that I'm clear in terms of what's covered here.
Exactly. That would be the distinguishing line between what the conservatives would allow versus what they wouldn't allow.
Okay.
And that really misses the point because hate speech is the free expression issue of our generation, of our decade, right? It used to be, you know, concerns about government censorship, but those concerns have just been blown past by just how much online hate ruins freedom of expression, mm-hmm. right? We know women, people of color, LGBTQ plus persons, when there's online hate, they self-censor, they are silenced, they face rape and death threats. You know, there was a journalist in Toronto who was on a radio station and she was discussing controversial topics or topics that would kind of make the far right angry. And she got so many like death threats and rape threats towards her one-year-old daughter that she quit, right? And who can blame her?
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it's awful. So like that's the real free expression issue here, right? If we remove online hate, we're going to protect the free expression rights of women, people of color, LGBTQ plus persons, equity deserving groups, right? And at what cost? Is there going to be a free expression cost to this? A little one, yeah. I mean, racist bigots and abusers are not going to be able to spout as much racism, bigotry, and abuse. And I, for one, think that there's a big net gain here where, you know, stop the abuse, let people participate in society.
Sure.
I think there's a net gain.
Let's talk about the NDP platform while we still have you here. And, you know, summarize it for us if you can and what's different about their platform, but also maybe how they could lead the conversation. I think it's fair to say at this point as we talk anyway that we're looking at potentially another minority government and where could they drive this topic? I know this is something that Jagmeet Singh has spoken about more than the other leaders.
The short version is that the NDP platform is very similar to the Liberal platform. You know, like the Liberals, they're promising a national action plan to dismantle far-right extremist organizations. We don't know exactly what that looks like because simply designating them terrorist organizations, as the Liberals have done, doesn't seem to accomplish that much. They've promised national standards for identifying and recording all hate incidents. That's good. If I read into that a little bit, what I'd like to see there, but this isn't spelled out in their platform, but what I'd like to see there is we need to repeat that survey I mentioned at the top of our conversation about asking people, have you been the victim of a hate crime? We need to repeat that more often and get that data out more quickly because you can't solve a problem or start working those numbers down and reducing the number of hate crimes if you're not accurately measuring it. So mm-hmm. measuring it's very important and they're the only ones that have kind of mentioned that in their platform. So that's good. Like the Liberals, they're promising legislation to require social media companies to remove hate. Here, I would only say that what the Liberals have proposed in like the technical paper of how it would work and how it would be accountable and transparent and have safeguards, but also be effective by requiring companies to kind of proactively remove that hate, is a good template to work off of. So I hope they wouldn't throw it out and start with something brand new when they could adapted and improve on what the Liberals have put forward in that technical paper. But they're promising largely the same stuff. They're also saying that we should have dedicated hate crime units. And most departments in large areas now do have hate crime officers or hate crime units, but they kind of operate in a different way. They basically get called in when there is a report of a hate crime, and they may certify or decertify whether it actually was a hate crime and may assist in the evidence collecting of the motivation behind the crime. That's not quite what they used to be like. So like 20 years ago, when we had Nazis marching through the streets, the hate crimes units were more like what you'd think of like a drugs and guns unit. Like they were more proactive in some of the cities and very actively kind of kicked hate groups to the curb. And they were just right. One small part here, right? Really the credit there goes to anti-racist action and the anti-fascists. But the police did play some role in messing with some of the hate groups. But I just fall back to, you know, the police are not necessarily the solution to hate crimes writ large. But for the kind of the serious ones that do require, law and order to be involved, it would be good to see that.
The last thing I want to ask you about kind of gets at what you mentioned previously about the mobs following the Prime Minister's campaign around. And it also gets at the role of law enforcement in these situations. At what point do the police need to be involved in it? Not necessarily saying it's a hate crime, but what is the significance of that kind of anger that we're seeing on the campaign trail?
Yeah, the police needed to be involved in this like a year and a half ago. The issue here is when the COVID conspiracy movement was forming, the far right in Canada entirely took it over, right? The entirety of the hate groups that we monitor, with like one exception, is part of the COVID conspiracy movement. And they've used the COVID conspiracy movement to recruit new people. So there are people in the COVID conspiracy movement, a lot of people who are racist, and there's a lot of people who are insurrectionary. Like they want a violent overthrow of government. They want to put somebody, a strong man, in power. They want to hold kangaroo court trials, and they want to execute the prime minister, provincial health authorities, and others, right? That's what they want to do. They want to violently overthrow the government and execute their perceived enemies.
Yeah.
And they've been doing protests and organizing around various issues. And every time they do a new issue, you know, is it M103? Is it Yellow Vests? Every time they take on a new rallying cry, they suck more people into themselves, right? They convince people, oh, we're talking about oil and gas. And people are like, oh, I'm concerned about oil and gas. And then they get into like this racist echo chamber, and some of them turn racist, is kind of how the far right works. And it's been growing in Canada since I started doing this work in 6 years. And again, I'd like to point out just how violent they are. They attack random passerby who heckle them or who happen to be wearing masks. You know, they go into grocery stores and malls and attack and harass, but also physically attack people who are asking them to, you know, wear masks or socially distance. If the police had cracked down on them early and cracked down on that violence early and laid significant charges early, it might have nipped this in the bud. However, once it had reached kind of a critical mass and they had tons and tons and tons and tons of people, any kind of police crackdown at that point plays into their persecution complex, right? They want to feel like there's a jackboot on their neck so hard because they've never had a real hard shake in their life, right? Like they're comparing the experience being asked to wear a mask to the Holocaust. These are not reasonable people. And they so badly want to be persecuted. So when, you know, they get a ticket now, or when somebody faces a little slap on the wrist charge, they cheerlead about it. So we're kind of past the point where police action writ large on a big number of them would be any effective. What we should see clearly and obviously is, you know, all the assaults that they do, they really should face pretty hard charges for that, right? No slap on the wrist stuff. So there's a limited amount law enforcement can do. And then we also run into the problem that the lockdown protesters think that law enforcement have their back. And when they think that law enforcement have their back, because in some cases law enforcement have their back for real, and in other cases they're just not sufficiently condemning them, when they think law enforcement has their back, they're more violent because they think they're going to face lesser or no consequences. So there's a few things the police could do now. You know, they could wear masks at every demonstration with these yahoos, whether or not they need to wear masks. They could, you know, when a COVID conspiracy protester is like, oh, thanks for marching with us, Mr. Police Officer, you know, they could say, I'm just here to do my job. I wish you'd go home. I don't agree with you. you know, very simple script, and the police writ large could condemn them broadly. That would help. And just kind of my final point, if we're talking law enforcement and security, is, you know, I can't believe how close these people are getting to the prime minister. I really hope that his security detail and our security services understand just how angry these people are and just how dangerous the situation is, because there's no organized attempt, like a group coming together to have a complicated assassination of a prime minister. That's not happening. What is happening is there's an environment that's been created where they're convinced he's like this biblical evil, and they're convinced that basically the apocalypse is happening and children are in danger and things of that nature. And they've created this environment where they're calling for violence towards him, and they feel that there is no legitimate way to address their grievances, right? They feel like voting won't work. So when that happens, when you have all those ingredients together, unstable people in a movement like that can take it upon themselves to try to act out the violent fantasies of the movement and try to use violence or murder. And that's the situation. It's not the threat, not like an organized threat we're worried about. It's a threat that looks organic and just kind of comes out of nowhere.
God, that's a scary way to end this conversation. Fingers crossed for the safety of everyone on the campaign trail over the next week and a half. Evan, thank you so much for this really detailed breakdown. It's much appreciated.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me for the conversation. I'm glad you gave me the chance to talk a lot and go through some of the nuance of it.
Evan Balgord, Executive Director of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. That was The Big Story. For more from us, you know where to go, thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. You can email us anytime, TheBigStoryPodcast, all one word, at rci.rogers.com. You can find us in your favorite podcast platform where you can like us, follow us, subscribe to us, rate us, review us, all for free. We never charge. All we ask in return is for you to tell a friend and hit those 5 stars. Stephanie Phillips is the lead producer of The Big Story. Joseph Fish and Ryan Clark are our associate producers. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Stay safe this weekend. Practice love, not hate, and we'll talk Monday.